Fresh ones. Awesome. Just very, very brief little bit of background for me. I'm Christchurch based. I've been an aircraft engineer for just over 40 years now, working on jet engines for most of that time. Private pilot's license. I'm not currently flying, but have done a bit of flying. And I just had this journey of discovering that science has not disproved the Bible, which got me really quite excited and passionate about this particular topic. So, hoping just to share some of that enthusiasm with you today. Okay. Just to mention that we have got some resources and things out in the foyer as well that you'll be able to look at a bit later on. Okay, today you're going to learn what Nefish life is, what Sir Edmund Hillary found at the top of Mount Everest, and what a Tygon is. I'm going to fire a lot at you. Are you ready? Strapped in? So, just a little brief overview. I'm representing a global organization called Creation Ministries International, and it exists to build the faith of Christians, to give them confidence in God's word and encourage them in evangelism. We say it's about arming God's army, and we're effectively an information ministry to the church. So how am I qualified to speak about Noah's flood? Well, this is my grandson. He's called Noah, and he's in his ark. I didn't think they had motorbikes in the Old Testament until I read Isaiah 58:14. I will cause you to ride in triumph on the heights of the land. The Bible describes a flood unlike anything before or since that wiped out every living thing on this planet except for a selection of people and animals on a huge lifeboat. And many today doubt the reality of this scenario. So today I want to look at three things. Firstly, why people are sceptical of the idea of a global flood. Secondly, does this even matter? And thirdly, we'll look at some evidence supporting Noah's flood. So why do people doubt the truth of the biblical account of Noah's flood? I think, firstly, there is general scepticism of the Bible as true and accurate, and this is the main reason that Creation Ministries exists, is to defend the truth of the Bible as an accurate record of the history of the universe. The Bible says in 2 Peter 3, 5-6, that people willingly close their minds about the flood, for they deliberately overlook this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. Secondly, I think some people have doubts about the practicalities of the ark. Could it have physically achieved what is claimed? We'll look at that a bit later on. And thirdly, within the scientific community, an idea called uniformitarianism dominated geology for around 200 years. This was popularized by Charles Lyell and James Hutton. It's essentially the idea that when we look to explain the features on the surface of this planet, we can only use processes that we see occurring today, i.e. slow, gradual processes. The catchphrase of uniformitarianism was the present is the key to the past. Now, this rule was based on a philosophy, not scientific evidence, and it effectively excluded any catastrophic events like a global flood. James Hutton declared that the past history of our globe must be explained by what can be seen to be happening now. No powers are to be employed that are not natural to the globe, no action to be admitted except those of which we know the principle. And Charles Lyell took a similar stance and even admitted to his desire to oppose the predominant belief of his time that the Bible gives a reliable history of our planet. In his words, he wanted to free the science from Moses. Warren D. Ellman, director of the Paleontological Research Institution in New York, an adjunct associate professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University, he must have a huge business card, stated about him, Lyell also sold geology some snake oil. He convinced geologists that all past processes acted at essentially their current rates. Almon also said this extreme gradualism has led to numerous unfortunate consequences, including the rejection of sudden or catastrophic events in the face of positive evidence for them, for no reason other than that they were not gradual. So as I said, this arbitrary rule that explanations of geological features must be based on slow and gradual processes was not based on scientific observation. And what's more, the slow and gradual processes we see occurring today don't do a very good job of explaining many of the features on the surface of this planet. There's lots of evidence of catastrophe. So I think that some of the main reasons why people struggle to accept the flood as real, skepticism of the Bible, doubts about the practicalities of the ark, and the idea of geological uniformitarianism. Now some would ask, why does it even matter? Some reasons this does matter. You may have heard this statement, and Mike referred to this yesterday, that the Bible is not a science textbook, the implication being that it's only useful as a framework to give us theological and moral guidance. Well, I would agree that the Bible is not a science textbook, but what the Bible itself does claim to be is a history book, covering the history of our planet and the whole universe from beginning to end. And much of the moral guidance provided in the Bible is based on the actual historical events described in it. But if we can't trust it to reliably describe the past, how can we trust it with our future? Speaking of history, did you know that we can describe the entire history of the planet from beginning to end in just 7 words? Those of you who were here yesterday, know that Mike covered this briefly. It's simply a memory aid for recalling the 7 major events in history, past and future, according to the Bible. First C is creation of the universe. Number 2 is corruption, the fall, when humans first rebelled against God and caused the entry of death and suffering into the world. Number 3, catastrophe, Noah's flood. Number 4, confusion. At the Tower of Babel, humans refused God's command to spread out and repopulate the earth after the flood, so he introduced different languages among them that forced them to move away from each other. Number 5, Christ, when Jesus came to earth in human form. Number 6, the cross, when Jesus was crucified and then rose from the dead. And number 7, consummation, when Jesus returns for the second time in a manner very different to the first. It's a great memory aid for that biblical big picture. So the flood is one of the 7 most significant events to happen on this planet. Note also that in Luke 17, Jesus raised parallels between the reality of the flood, a past event, and the reality of a future event, his second coming. Another reason this topic matters is that we need to be able to respond to questions and challenges about the Bible. The Apostle Peter tells us this in 1 Peter 3:15. People are constantly being told directly and indirectly that the Bible is a collection of myths that have been disproved by science and that it has no relevance to us today. We need to be equipped to defend the Bible against skeptical attack and show that it's incredibly relevant for every human on this planet. A quick quiz to test your knowledge. How many of each kind of animal did Moses take on the ark? 2? None? 7 of some? Did someone say none? You're onto it. Moses didn't take any. Noah did. He walked right into that one. Why did Noah build the ark from gopher wood? He didn't have an ark welder. Do we know the name of Noah's wife? We do. She was Joan of Arc. Little known fact about Noah. The Bible then indicates that as well as being a master boat builder, he was also a very astute businessman. We can deduce this from the fact that his stock floated while the rest of the world went into liquidation. Sorry for the dad jokes. I'm a granddad, so it just gets worse. So what does the Bible actually describe regarding the flood. Well, about 1,650 years after creation, human behaviour has got so bad that God regrets that he has created people. God identifies Noah as a righteous man in contrast to the rest of the people alive at the time. And God confides in Noah that he's going to destroy all life on earth and commissions him to build a huge boat to allow for the survival of the people and animals required to repopulate the earth after the flood. Noah obediently does as he's asked, and right on cue, the flood arrives. Water completely covers the surface of the earth, being supplied by both non-stop rain and subterranean sources for a period of 40 days. The water level continues to rise for another 110 days until it covers the whole earth, including the mountains. The flood drowns all living things except those on board the ark. Then the flood waters begin to subside. This takes another 210 days, during which time the ark runs aground on the mountains of Ararat. Noah waits until the earth is fully dried out and there is evidence of plants regenerating before disembarking with his family and all the animals. A very welcome prospect for all involved, I imagine. Then God promises never to destroy the earth again by means of a flood. This is an important point we'll come back to. He instructs Noah and his family that they are to repopulate the whole earth. Now, I just want to give a little bit further explanation of some of the points that may not be obvious from a quick read of the biblical text. I mentioned before that the flood drowned all living things except those on board the ark. So we need to define what is a living thing in the biblical sense. God makes some general statements about destroying all living things in the flood. For example, Genesis 6:13, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And Genesis 7:4, every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground. But he also makes some more specific statements defining what he means by all living things. Genesis 6:17, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. And Genesis 7:21-22, and all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. The biblical word life in this context comes from the Hebrew word nephesh. And we can deduce the meaning of nephesh life from various verses in the Bible. I won't give you all the detail here, but we can determine the following points about the biblical definition of life. Nephesh life is normally translated as living creatures when referring to animals and living soul when referring to humans. And it conveys the sense of a breathing creature. It links life with the presence of blood. Land vertebrates, animals with a backbone, are included. Birds are included in this definition. Fish are considered nephesh creatures, but they're not included in God's description of the animals destroyed in the flood, and have been shown to be tolerant of changes in salinity, so they could survive the flood without assistance. What is excluded from this definition of life? Well, insects. Insects don't breathe through the nostrils, but through tiny tubes in the exterior skeleton, and they don't have blood in the true sense. Also, insects would be capable of surviving the flood on floating mats of vegetation. Single-celled organisms like bacteria are not regarded as nephesh life, and nephesh life never refers to plants. Another thing that may not be obvious from the text is the enormity and the violence of the flood. As I said yesterday, the flood was not a tranquil raising of the water level, but an incredibly catastrophic and destructive event. Noah's flood involved huge amounts of energy. Nothing we see today comes even close. It involved volcanic and tectonic activity on a massive scale. The whole surface of the earth was dramatically reshaped. This is supported by the verses in the Bible that explain the sources of the water. Genesis 7:11. On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of heaven were opened. The windows of heaven obviously refers to torrential rain. The fountains of the great deep could refer to subterranean water sources. Another possible explanation for this is that as the tectonic plates began to separate, seawater would have flowed into the gaps, contacted molten magma, and been converted into geysers of superheated steam. And this would also have the effect of increasing the amount of moisture in the atmosphere and increasing the rain. So we've looked at why this matters and what the Bible describes. What evidence do we have that this event actually occurred? We have evidence both from within the Bible and also outside of the Bible that supports Noah's flood being a real, historical, global event. From within the Bible, firstly, there is the description of the flood in the Old Testament book of Genesis, which, by the way, is not written in the style of poetry or symbolic writing, as some claim. It's very clearly literal narrative or history. Then there is also support for the flood from the New Testament. Jesus and some of the New Testament writers referred to a real global flood. Luke 17, 26, 27, Jesus said, "Just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." The Apostle Peter also tells us in 2 Peter 2:5, "If he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." There's also lots of evidence from outside of the Bible. Let's take a look at some of that. First, flood legends. If a global flood had occurred as described in the Bible, we would expect to find mention of this in the history of various cultures around the world. And this is exactly what we find. Legends of a huge flood in cultures all across the world. For example, there is the Gilgamesh epic that Mike mentioned, described on tablets from ancient Mesopotamia. The Australian Aboriginals have several flood stories, and there are others from the Aztecs, North American Indians, China, Egypt, Peru, Scandinavia, the list goes on. In fact, we find over 500 flood legends. And they show amazing similarity with the Genesis flood, though being somewhat distorted by time and retelling. The usual features of these legends are the gods or a god decide to send a deluge on the world, usually as a punishment for some act. Certain human beings are warned, or it may come without warning. If warned, the people construct some kind of vessel, a raft, ark, ship, a big canoe or the like, or find some other means of escape. Sometimes they also save certain things essential to a way of life. The deluge comes, rain, a huge wave, a container broken or opened, a monster's belly punctured, etc. Bird or rodent scouts are often sent out. And when the deluge is over, the survivors find themselves on a mountain or an island. Sometimes they offer a sacrifice and then repopulate the earth, recreate animals by some miraculous means. So we find flood legends with striking similarities all over the world, exactly as we would expect if the flood were real and global. There were eight people on the ark: Noah, his wife, their three sons, and their wives. An interesting side note is that the Chinese word for ship is a pictogram incorporating the symbols vessel, eight, and people. Interesting. The next piece of evidence is the fossil record. And again, we looked at this a bit yesterday. That fossils even exist in the numbers that we find is evidence for the flood. This is because fossils require quite rare and specific conditions to form. This includes rapid and complete burial to exclude oxygen and prevent carnivores from tearing the dead animal apart. Now, we find fossilized animals all over the planet in rock laid down by water. Your amazing fact of the day is that we find marine fossils at the top of Mount Everest. In 1953, Sir Edmund Hillary brought rocks back from the top of Everest that contained crinoids, marine sea lilies. In fact, there are marine fossils at the top of most mountain chains. Remember, I told you how dramatically the flood affected the surface of the earth? This is powerful evidence in support of that. For example, we find clams on mountaintops. And interestingly, the shells are closed, which indicates rapid burial. Clamshells tend to open after they die in normal circumstances. This fits really well with the biblical model, which has today's mountain chains forming towards the end or after the flood. So we have a real fossil to pass around today for you to have a look at. He's a Phacops trilobite, which is an extinct marine arthropod. His name is Doug. It's purely coincidental. And he was very likely fossilised during Noah's flood about 4,500 years ago. As a side note, secular scientists interpret the fossils in the different geological layers as the record of the development of the living things over long periods of time. Biblical scientists interpret the fossils in the different geological layers as a sequence of burial of animals in the flood over a relatively short space of time, the less mobile ones being buried first, and the more mobile ones being able to move to higher ground before being overcome by the floodwaters. There's lots of scientific support for the biblical version of these two interpretations. Next, let's take a quick look at geology, which provides some fascinating evidence for Noah's flood. Geomorphology is the subfield of geology that studies the shape of the Earth's surface, and it's a goldmine of evidence for the global flood. The following is extracted from an article titled Geomorphology Provides Multiple Evidences for the Global Flood by Michael Ord. In the early 1900s, secular scientists thought that it would be easy to understand the origin of landforms after they rejected the Genesis flood. By 1974, C.H. Crickmay, a Canadian geologist, was amazed that after all these years, landforms still remained unexplained. He said that though there are plenty of hypotheses of geomorphic evolution, there is not one that would not be rejected by any majority vote for all competent minds. Crickmay is not alone. C.P. Green says it became increasingly evident after 1960 that no satisfactory understanding of geomorphological processes existed. This is an amazing admission. The previous quotes are a bit dated, but the situation is actually much the same today. Ord says it's perhaps ironic that after 200 years of research and data collection, there is still little unanimity in the development and acceptance of the theoretical understanding of the development of the Earth's sina, its geomorphology. Some of the landforms that need explaining. Mountains. Perhaps the most prominent landform on every continent, the origin of mountains is still not well understood. Evolutionary geomorphologists Cliff Ollier and Colin Payne wrote a provocative book in 2000, The Origin of Mountains, listing 20 different mechanisms proposed for the uplift of mountains, none of which can be demonstrated. Planation surfaces. These elevated, flat-topped landforms covering large areas of the Earth are not forming today and are very difficult for evolutionary geologists to explain. In their 2015 book, Calvert and Gunnell state, such low-grade features are enigmatic, and the chances of survival of planar landforms in mountain environments are slim. Inselbergs. These erosional remnants are steep-sided hills or mountains that sometimes stand alone in open plains. Ayers Rock, or Uluru, is the most famous example. They're usually said to be millions of years old, but if that were true, they would have eroded away completely long ago. According to one secular scientist, the early geomorphological history and the fundamental reasons for Ayers Rock remain obscure, though various possibilities have been suggested. Pediments. These smooth, flat planation surfaces commonly occur alongside mountains, ridges, or plateaus. They are gently sloping, nearly flat surfaces of bedrock. Murray Strudley and P.K. have stated, the curious and ubiquitous nature of this landform suite has baffled geologists for over a century. Hard rounded rocks transported long distances. Pediments and planation surfaces are often covered by hard rounded rocks. These can be found on mountaintops and also piled up thousands of metres deep in cracks in the Earth's surface. These were clearly rounded by water and also transported by water very long distances, more than 1,000 kilometres from their source, which is impossible to explain by the geological processes that we see acting today. Water gaps. Water gaps are where rivers appear to have chosen to flow through mountain barriers when nearby there was an easy downhill path around the barrier. There are literally thousands of water gaps around the world. Thomas Oberlander, who has extensively researched water gaps, describes them as a geomorphic problem, and he laments the apparent absence of evidence for their origin. Looking finally at submarine geomorphology, the mysteries for secular geologists also continue under the ocean. They're unable to explain the origin of the very thick border of sedimentary rocks called the continental margin that surrounds every continent and even large islands. In some places, erosional canyons have cut through the continental margin, and they can be thousands of metres deep, hundreds of kilometres long. Some are deeper than the Grand Canyon. Again, secular geology has difficulty explaining them. H.D. Hedberg stated there is considerable controversy as to the origin and detail of continental slopes. It seems evident that there is no unique answer. The Genesis flood clears up these apparent mysteries. The majority of the erosion and deposition of the Earth's surface took place during the runoff of the floodwater, when the mountains and continents rose and the ocean basins sank. The water first flowed as wide currents. Then as more mountains and plateaus were exposed, the water was forced to channelize around these obstacles. The rapidly flowing wide currents planed the surface flat and deposited hard, rounded rocks that were transported hundreds of kilometers from their source. Occasionally, tall inselbergs like Ayers Rock were spared from destruction, leaving them dotted over some planation surfaces. The channelized flow carved valleys and canyons, in some cases cutting through rock that was soon to form mountain ranges. This explains how water gaps are often found today cutting through mountains and ridges rather than going around them. The rapid channelized currents flowed down valleys, forming wide flat pediments and capping them with rounded rocks. These currents didn't stop as they exited the continents, but were strong enough to cut deep, deep submarine canyons in the newly deposited sediments on the continental margin. So not only does the Genesis flood explain all these so-called mysteries of geomorphology, these landforms are found worldwide, confirming that the flood was actually global, as the Bible records. Now, this may seem a little bit left field, but I want to look briefly at ice ages. What do we know about ice ages? There are hundreds of land features around that are similar to existing glaciers, some of which can only be formed by ice. So it's reasonable to assume that there was at least one ice age. Secular science proposes several ice ages, possibly as many as 50, over the past 2.6 million years. But secular science also has a real problem explaining what could cause one ice age. There are over 60 theories, and they've been wrestling with this issue for over 200 years. Climate expert Didier Payard, writing in Science about the so-called ice ages, said the big challenge is to build an ice age theory that works, and he admits that a final solution still eludes us. Creationists propose only one ice age, about 4,000 years ago. Any idea what might have caused it? Noah's flood created the perfect conditions to cause an ice age. There are three conditions required to initiate and maintain an ice age. We need cooler summers than now, or the ice sheets would thaw. We need increased precipitation of moisture from the atmosphere. This would fall as snow in the cooler latitudes. And the climate disruption must persist for hundreds of years to allow the ice sheets to form. As I said earlier, the flood involved lots of volcanic activity. Volcanic particles in the atmosphere would have blocked out the sun and cooled the earth. Now, warm seas from the volcanic activity and the addition of subterranean water would have increased the evaporation going up into the atmosphere. Subsequent storm activity on a huge scale would have dumped massive amounts of snow, which would turn to ice. Now, the dust in the atmosphere from the volcanic eruptions would gradually sink out of the atmosphere, but was being replaced for a time by post-flood volcanism. So the earth remained cool for hundreds of years. Eventually, the volcanic particles would clear, evaporation would cool down the oceans, and less moisture generated by the cooler seas would create less snow, and the ice age would wind down. The Ice Age is estimated to have peaked in about 500 years and taken another 200 years to wind down. In case you're wondering how people survived the Ice Age, it can be helpful to clarify that an Ice Age doesn't mean that the whole planet is covered in ice. The ice sheets simply increase in size and move further towards the equator. So the Ice Age is strong evidence for the flood and is very difficult to explain without the flood. Some more interesting evidence that supports the flood, and we looked at these some of these this morning. Straight dinosaur tracks. We find dinosaur tracks all over the world, and they're almost always in straight lines. This indicates that the animals were panicking. Animal tracks tend to meander when they're relaxed. And we find evidence of swim tracks left by dinosaurs. Dr. Taz Walker describes what these are. Swim tracks are found all over the world, including dinosaur tracks in northern Spain, which consist of claw marks made in the sand surface as the animal was on tiptoes trying to move through deep flowing water. This has just been a very small selection of the evidence supporting the flood. We have masses of evidence, both from within the Bible and also outside of the Bible, supporting Noah's flood as a real event. As I said earlier, the Bible itself and the flood story are subject to quite a bit of sceptical attack, but analysis of the known facts shows us that all the questions can be answered quite easily. So let's take a quick look at some of the supposed challenges levelled at the story of the flood. One thing that can help encourage the idea that the whole story is impractical and a myth is the cartoon-style caricatures of the ark that we often see that make it look like an overloaded bathtub. When this is our default image of the ark, we can forget how enormous this vessel really was. Over 130 metres long, cargo space of 43,000 cubic metres, 15,000 tonnes capacity, equivalent of 522 railroad wagons. More than capable of carrying the required number of animals and shown to be an extremely stable design. We have a small cardboard model of the ark that we'll pass around that just gives you some idea of the shape and dimensions. Another question is, where did all the water come from and where did it end up? I would suggest to you that there was plenty of water available on the planet and it's still there. The Earth holds vast amounts of water. When we look at a globe of the Earth, we're normally focused on the green bits, but next time you do that, have a look at the blue bits, and you'll note that most of it is blue. In fact, 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water now. And if we levelled the Earth's surface, water would cover the whole planet to a depth of 2.7 kilometres. The high mountains we see today didn't need to be covered by the flood because they didn't exist then. Mount Everest is 9 kilometres high, but today's mountains were formed at the end of or after the flood by tectonic activity, as I said before. And this is supported by the evidence I gave earlier about the layers in the uppermost parts of Mount Everest being composed of fossil-bearing, water-deposited layers. So the amount of water is no problem at all. A humorous little side note here is that demonstrates the effect of uniformitarian thinking. Mars has almost no water, but uniformitarians have decided there is good evidence of massive flooding here in the past. When asked about this soggy little planet that we live in, they confidently declare there is no evidence of any global flood here. British geologist Derek Agar put it well when he said, "We have allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into avoiding any interpretation of the past that involves extreme and what might be termed catastrophic processes." Now, some would suggest that it was just a local flood. This idea falls apart very quickly when we read the flood account and think logically about it. The Bible says that the flood covered all the high mountains under the entire heavens to a depth of 8 metres. If you think about it, it's impossible for a local flood to cover all the high mountains under the entire heavens. If not a global flood, why have an ark? They could have just moved out of the area affected. If not a global flood, why have a vessel big enough to hold all vertebrate animals? If not a global flood, why have birds on the ark? They could have just flown to an area unaffected by the flood. If it was only a local flood, then God would have repeatedly broken his promise never to send such a flood again. There have been countless major local floods throughout history. There are many more reasons to accept the flood as indeed being global. Returning to the capability of the ark to do what was required, we need to ask the question, what was on the ark? People often overestimate the number of animals that needed to be carried. In Genesis 6:19-20, God tells Noah to bring a pair of every kind of animal, a male and a female, into the boat to keep them alive during the flood. Now, this sounds impossible when we think about the huge numbers of different types of animals around today. However, the Bible doesn't say that the variety of animals we see today were on the ark. It says that two of every kind of animal came on board. And we don't know with certainty exactly what the biblical word kind describes, but it's probably reasonably closely represented by the word species today. The common definition of species is a group of organisms which can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. God pre-programmed or front-loaded huge genetic variation into those animal kinds. So, for example, there didn't need to be pairs of horses and donkeys and zebras on the ark. One representative pair of the equine kind carried all the genetic variation needed to diversify into those different types after the flood. Similarly, one pair of the canine kind on the ark would later on diversify into dogs, wolves, dingoes, coyotes, foxes, jackals, and so on. And the same story with domestic cats, lions, tigers, leopards, and cheetahs. And we find that this diversification from a small number of original kinds in a type of genetic bottleneck is supported by the modern study of genetics. This model is also supported by the animal hybrids we see today. For example, ligers and tigons, hybrids of lions and tigers. And geep, the offspring of a goat and a sheep. Zonkey, you can probably work that one out. There are also zorses and zonies. And wolfins. The name was first applied to the hybrid of a false killer whale and a bottlenose dolphin born in captivity in the 1980s. Wolfins, not to be confused with wolfin, the hybrid between a dolphin and a wolf, which is so rare, it's only ever been seen on Photoshop. He's still awake, it's good. Interbreeding is only possible between animals that originated from the same kind. So because only two of each kind were required, we're already looking at a huge reduction in the number of animals needing to be carried on the ark compared with what we see on the planet today. Remember that God brought the animals to Noah, and he chose representatives of each kind that carried enough genetic variation to be able to diversify into all the subspecies that exist today. And we can reduce the number even further when we remember that insects are excluded from the biblical definition of living things and that fish didn't need to be carried on the ark. Another consideration is that the animals didn't need to be fully grown adults but would most likely have been smaller juveniles. Even most dinosaurs are not that big. The average size is about the same as a buffalo. One study has suggested that the median size of the animals on the ark was about that of a small rat, with only 11% being much larger than a sheep. And it's been estimated that around 8,000 kinds or 16,000 individual animals would have needed to be carried. Returning again briefly to uniformitarianism, the idea of millions of years of Earth history that seemed to be supported by geology, people looked at the huge depth of sedimentary layers in the Earth's crust and assumed that the layers must have been laid down gradually, which would, of course, take a long time under normal circumstances. Apologies for those of you who have heard this yesterday. But could the layers have been laid down rapidly? Well, Noah's flood gives us this mechanism where massive sedimentary layers would have been laid down all over the earth in a relatively short space of time. And we've seen modern evidence of this happening, albeit on a much smaller scale. We have observed rapid formation of sedimentary layers. Mount St. Helens in the USA erupted on the 18th of May 1980, and one of the results was an 8-metre thick sedimentary deposit exposed in a cliff alongside the North Fork Turtle River. It's composed of finely layered sediment, and if we didn't know better, could assume that it had been laid down layer by layer over long periods of time, except that we know this whole deposit formed in just 3 hours because it was observed. Mount St. Helens eruption also demonstrated how canyons and channels can be formed much faster than conventionally thought. The ongoing eruptions eroded the thick sediment dumped at the base of the volcano, producing channels and canyons. One of these channels, named the Little Grand Canyon, had side walls up to 40 metres high and a small stream running through it. Someone seeing that canyon might conclude that it was eroded slowly by the small creek over many hundreds or thousands of years. However, the formation of the canyon was documented. It was carved by a mud flow in a single day on the 19th of March 1982. Other canyons on the flanks of the volcano show us that it's not just the softer material that can be eroded quickly. Lewitt Canyon, it's over 30 metres deep, was gouged in part through old, hard volcanic rock called andesite by mud flows in just a few months in the second half of 1980. So we have plenty of evidence that sedimentary layers can form quickly and can be eroded very quickly also. And the real Grand Canyon, as we learnt yesterday, is another incredible example. We can clearly see the rock layers. And you may not be aware, this is powerful evidence for rapid deposition of sedimentary rock, because the lines between the layers are extremely flat and sharp. These supposedly represent gaps in time of millions of years, but if those surfaces had in fact been exposed for millions of years before the next one was laid down, they wouldn't be flat. They would be heavily eroded. And this picture shows the sharp, flat contact line between Coconino sandstone above and the Hermit Shale below. It's supposed to be a 10 million year interval between these two layers of the Grand Canyon, but this contact goes for hundreds of kilometres with no sign of erosion between the layers. This is strong evidence they were laid down rapidly. Back to the physical size of the Ark. At 137 metres long, 23 metres wide, and 13.7 metres high, volume of over 43,000 cubic metres, it was enormous. Now, some people question the ability of so-called ancient people to even construct a vessel of this size. But we have evidence of other ancient ships of this sort of size, indicating that it was technically feasible for people of this era to build a ship like this. Plus, this one had a superior designer. What about the food needed, and how was waste dealt with? Feasibility studies have been carried out to address and answer all these questions, including the seaworthiness and stability of the Ark, which, as we said, was excellent due to its shape and dimensions, according to a study by a naval architect. So I can hope you can see there's lots and lots of evidence in a wide variety of areas supporting the biblical account of a real global flood with a real Ark, providing the means of escape for enough people and animals to start again and repopulate the planet. This has just been a very brief overview, but for lots more information about the Ark, go online to creation.com or have a look at the resource tables afterwards. As I said this morning, you probably retain and remember very little of what I tell you, but if you can take away a book or a DVD and digest it, that's when the shift will happen. A few resources relating to this topic. Our most popular book is the Creation Answers book. It carries the answers to more than 60 of the most commonly asked questions about creation, evolution, and the book of Genesis. And the Creation Answers book has 7 chapters that relate to the flood. How Noah's Flood Shaped Our Earth. In this book, researchers Ord and Reed have compiled geological evidence for the flood, as well as providing an easily understood interpretation of the dynamic processes that occurred before, during, and after the flood, which radically altered this planet. A couple of DVDs, The Great Ice Age by Michael Ord and Mount St. Helens by Dr. Steve Austin. And for children, the book Exploring Geology with Mr. Hibb has lots of flood information as well as ideas for practical hands-on activities. And in case you don't have the means to play DVDs, we've launched a video streaming service on creation.com where you can rent or buy video content and stream it to your device or smart TV. So having established there's heaps of evidence supporting Noah's flood as a real event in history, we come full circle and ask again, why does this matter? Well, the Bible is not only an accurate record of the history of the world looking back, it also gives us some incredibly important information about our future. The Bible tells us that this planet as we know it now will end when Jesus returns for the second time. There's a fascinating passage in 2 Peter in the New Testament of the Bible. We looked at part of this at the beginning. Knowing this, first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. They will say, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were since the beginning of creation. For they deliberately overlooked this fact that the heavens existed long ago and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. Three interesting pieces of information from this passage. Firstly, even as people cast doubt on the truth of the biblical history, the Bible predicts that they will do this. Secondly, did you see the reference in there to uniformitarianism, the idea that only currently observable processes can be used to explain what we see in the world around us? And thirdly, the Bible tells us that Jesus will return to earth again, and it links the reality of his second coming with the reality of Noah's flood. When people discover that the Bible is a reliable record of the history of this planet, they are much more likely to take seriously what it says about the future. Referring again to those seven seas of history, the seventh sea, the consummation, describes how Jesus will come to earth for the second time, but in a manner very different to his first visit. The first six seas have occurred exactly as described in the Bible. How foolish would we be to think that the seventh sea, the consummation, won't also happen as predicted in God's word. So as we've talked about Noah's flood being a very real event, I hope you've been encouraged to trust God's word as a reliable record of the rest of history. I hope you've been encouraged that skeptical challenge to the flood story can be answered easily. And I hope that inspires you to talk to others about this hugely significant event in the history of this planet and the human race. Almost everybody was unprepared for the flood, and many people will be unprepared for Jesus' return. Can I encourage you not to fall into the group described as scoffers in 2 Peter 3, drifting through life, believing that things will always continue as they have. Instead, we need to be focused and alert, understanding the true history of this planet as well as what's to come. I want to give the final word to God. In Isaiah 46:9, he says, I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Thank you for listening.